1.
You will hear a woman talking on the telephone to a man about a car he is selling. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 4. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 4.
Hello, Brian Park speaking.
Oh, hello. I'm calling about the advert in the paper.
For the car?
Yes, the Mini you've got advertised for sale.
Oh, yes.
I just wanted to find out a bit more information.
Of course. What would you like to know?
It's my brother who's interested, actually, but he's not in today, so he asked me to call you.
Fine.
Great, thanks. So, it's a Mini?
Yep.
And how old is it?
Just coming up to 13 years old.
And I seem to remember from the ad that it's grey.
That's it. Doesn't show the dirt.
Absolutely. Anyway, the colour shouldn't be a problem for Jeff. You know, the important thing is the quality.
Yes, of course.
And what about mileage? With it being pretty old, it's probably over 100,000?
Actually, it's 40,000 less than that. 62,000 on the clock.
Great. I remember now. I'm confusing it with another ad I was looking at.
Right. Pleasant surprise then.
Yeah. Have you been the only owner, or was there a previous one?
I'm the second one. Before, it was owned by a teacher, who was a very careful driver, didn't have any accidents.
Very good. And what about you? What do you tend to use it for?
I haven't used it all that much, mostly for shopping. You know, this sort of thing.
So not much wear and tear. I'll make a note of that. I know Jeff wanted me to check that.
Right.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 5 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 5 to 10.
Now, about the price, I see you've got it down as £1,250. I'm not sure Jeff will be able to come up with that amount.
In the ad, I did say £1,250 or nearest offer.
So, would you be prepared to go down to £1,000?
That's really too low, I'm afraid.
£1,100?
I might be able to go to that.
OK, I'll make a note of that. What about tax? Is it due soon?
Got another 5 months before it's due.
Oh, that's a real plus, yes. I'll make a note of that.
OK.
Now, you say it's in good condition.
For its age, I'd say yes, definitely. It's just been serviced and there were no major problems.
Major?
I'd be able to show you the service report. The only thing is, you'd have to get a new tyre in the near future. Though it's still okay, you know. It's certainly absolutely safe at the moment.
Okay, fair enough. Yes, I understand.
And the garage also mentioned that one headlight could probably do with replacing. They think there's a fault there, you know, intermittent...
Well, we'd obviously look at all the documents, but that sounds very straightforward.
Of course. I've got all the service documents up to date, and you can look at those.
Well, it all sounds pretty good, and I know my brother will be interested, so would it be possible for him to see the car? He's back from his trip tomorrow, and away tonight, so how about tomorrow?
Tomorrow? Wednesday? I'm afraid that's not possible. I'm out pretty much all day.
Well, Thursday then?
That'd be fine, yeah.
In the morning?
Yes, that'd suit me perfectly.
Great.
Now, you'll need my address.
Oh, yes, of course. What is it?
It's number 238.
238?
London Road.
Oh, that's easy enough.
Yes, very straightforward.
So I'll pass on these notes to Jeff, and he'll see you in a couple.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a recorded message giving information about an animal park. First, you will have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully to the first part of the message and answer questions 11 to 15.
Welcome to the Australian Wildlife Park Information Line. The Australian Wildlife Park is very proudly owned and operated by an Australian family, John and Amanda Brooks, who operate the Australian Wildlife Park with their children, David and Sandra. The family doesn't receive any government assistance. It's solely funded by tourists visiting the park. Thank you for your support and assistance. When the Brooks family purchased the Australian Wildlife Park in 1987, the park housed a small collection of animals and birds on a modest 5-acre or 2-hectare property. A few years later, the park doubled in size when the family purchased the adjoining property. Also, the collection of animals started to boom. In May 2003, the family designed and built a new park in the public open space, once again more than doubling in size. The park now features about 200 species with more than 2,000 head of animals, birds and reptiles. Regarding the entry fee, adults pay $23, children aged 3 to 14 pay $10, age pensioners are $17 and students are $16. One of the great things about the Australian Wildlife Park is that all of the attractions are included in the entry fee. No extra money is needed around the park, so make the most of your experience. All shows, talks, photo opportunities and animal food are included in your entry fee. In addition, the Australian Wildlife Park is open every day of the year from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., except Christmas Day, 25th of December.
Before the final part of the message, you now have 20 seconds to look at questions 16 to 20. Now answer questions 16 to 20.
Several attractions are available to visitors to the Australian Wildlife Park. Firstly, you can meet the koalas between 10 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Here, people can view the koala colony in a natural environment. Another attraction is to feed the kangaroos between 9 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. Visitors can take a walk through the kangaroo enclosure, viewing them in a natural environment. Kangaroo food is provided and the kangaroos are very friendly. Also enjoyable are the wombats. At 11 a.m, 2 p.m. and 3:45 p.m, there are interactive shows where the team is delighted to introduce you to these popular animals. Other attractions that may interest you are an interactive farmyard, suitable for children of all ages. Animal food is provided and the animals are very friendly. In addition, The working farm is where the country comes to town. Visitors can milk a cow, bottle feed a lamb, watch farm dogs gathering the sheep. All the excitement of a real Australian farm. When they ask for volunteers, be sure to put your hand up. Everyone can get involved. We at the Australian Wildlife Park hope all our visitors have an enjoyable time. See you soon.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear two engineering students, a woman in her sixth year called Linda and a man in his fifth year called Matthew, discussing the benefits of student work placements. Before you listen, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen and answer questions 21 to 26.
Hi, Linda. Can you spare a few minutes?
Hello, Matthew. No problem.
I just wanted to talk to you about temporary work placements. I've never really thought there was a good reason for doing one. I've got some savings, so I don't really need the money at the moment. But I've had an email from the university about a vacancy that looks quite interesting. You did a placement last year, didn't you?
I did, yes. In my case, I wanted to find out if I was making the right career choice before I began applying for permanent jobs. I thought I wanted to work in car manufacturing, but I wasn't sure, so I applied to Toyota.
What was the application process like?
Lengthy. There were a lot of different parts to it. The dullest one was a psychometric test. You know, when you have to answer loads of questions about yourself.
And you're trying to guess what's the best thing to say.
Yes. Then there was an activity that we did in groups, which I found really fascinating. Engineers are renowned for being a bit unsociable, but I thought we made a great team. And we had an individual task, too. We had to sort through various business documents and prioritize them. It was just like what you have to do as a student, really, just with different content.
What exactly were you doing on the placement?
I was helping to design some diagnostic software to identify any waste in the car assembly process.
Do you mean waste of materials?
No, time. Anything that can speed the process up helps to cut costs.
How did the work placement compare to being a student? Was it hard work?
Yes, it was. I'd had full-time work before. I've done various unskilled jobs during university holidays, and some of those involve long hours. So I thought I'd find it easy. I was wrong, though. I think when you're on placement, you're always trying to prove yourself.
So you push yourself hard to succeed?
Yes. But I got a lot of support from my employers. They were always helpful. And then, at the end of the placement, I was given formal feedback.
Do you mean on your engineering ability?
Well, no. I didn't really need that because we had team meetings every other day. And so I had the chance to discuss technical issues and ask about anything that wasn't clear. The evaluation was about general workplace things, like organizational ability, initiative, that sort of thing.
I get the impression you think you benefited from the placement.
Well, the best thing is that they've offered me a job for next year. Depending on my exam results, of course, but still.
A permanent one?
Yes. But apart from that, I learned so much. The industrial environment was much more demanding than the academic one. So my general skills improved, like time management, meeting deadlines. And on the technical side, I learned new software packages, like MS Project.
Well, I think you've convinced me that work placements are worthwhile, but while you're here, can you give me advice on something else?
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 27 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 27 to 30.
I'm about to make a start on the engineering materials module, and I've got a book list here. Can you have a quick look and tell me what you would recommend? That's if you can remember.
Let's see. I do remember some of them. Yes, this one, The Science of Materials. I found the subject quite hard generally, but this book is very accessible, so it suited me. It doesn't cover everything, though.
What about this one, then? Materials Engineering.
Oh, yes. I do remember that. But it's a bit out of date now, isn't it? Unless it's a new edition.
I don't think so.
But what I liked about it were the pictures. They really helped to understand the descriptions. It's useful just from that point of view. Let's see. What else? Oh, yes. That one there. Engineering Basics. I think out of all these, that's got the widest coverage.
But I've looked at the contents page and it hardly mentions nanotechnology.
Yes, you're right. The Evolution of Materials does, though. It's a recent publication, so it covers all the latest developments. It's a bit thin on the 1960s, though, and that decade was quite important.
Well, it sounds as if they all complement each other in some ways. I don't suppose you can lend me...
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
You'll hear a lecture on MSG. First, you have some time to read questions 32 to 41. Now listen to the conversation and answer questions 32 to 41. You've probably noticed that MSG appears regularly among the ingredients of your favourite foods. But what is it? How long has it been used? How is it used? MSG, or monosodium glutamate, is a chemical commonly used to add flavour to salty or sour tasting foods. The average person knows almost nothing about it, but today MSG is found in everything from potato chips to soup. Its principal component is an amino acid called glutamic acid or glutamate. It was identified by Professor Kikune Aikida in 1908, but Eastern cooks have been using glutamate-rich seaweed as flavouring for more than 1,200 years. Glutamate is found in two forms. Bound glutamate, which is linked to other amino acids forming a protein molecule, and free glutamate, that has no link to protein. Only free glutamate is effective in enhancing the flavour of food. Foods often used for their flavouring qualities, such as tomatoes and mushrooms, have high levels of naturally occurring free glutamate. MSG is usually produced through fermentation of corn, sugar beets, or sugar cane. The finished product is a pure white crystal, which dissolves easily and blends well in many foods. Monosodium glutamate enhances the basic flavor of many foods. New studies also show that MSG elicits a unique taste that is known as umami in Japan and often described by Americans as a savory, broth-like, or meaty taste. Umami may be the fifth basic taste, beyond salty, sweet, sour, and bitter. As an integral part of cuisines around the world, this savory taste is common to the bouillons of Europe, the oyster sauce of China, the soy and fish sauces of Southeast Asia, the pizza of Italy, and the chowders and stews of America. MSG helps bring out the best natural flavors in a variety of foods such as meat, poultry, seafood, and vegetables. While MSG harmonizes well with salty and sour tastes, it contributes little or nothing to sweet or bitter foods. Results of taste panel studies indicate that a level of 0.1 to 0.8% MSG by weight in food provides optimum enhancement of the food's natural flavor. This is within the range of glutamate that naturally occurs in foods. Approximately 1/2 teaspoon of MSG is an effective amount to enhance the flavor of a pound of meat or 4 to 6 servings of vegetables or soup. MSG is a self-limiting substance. Once the proper amount is used, adding more contributes little to food flavor. Overuse of MSG, as with many other seasonings and spices, may cause some foods to have an undesirable taste. There is simply no substitute for wholesome quality food and good cooking techniques. MSG makes good quality food taste better, but will not improve the flavor of poor quality food. Disturbingly, scientists have known since the 1960s that MSG kills brain cells in young animals. Further research suggested that MSG may also be responsible for ailments ranging from skin rashes to irregular heartbeat and depression. Reports vary on just what percentage of the population is sensitive to MSG. One researcher put the figure as high as 30%, but food industry-sponsored studies have suggested it as low as 1 to 2%. Baby food manufacturers agreed to take MSG out of their products in the 1970s, but it is still widely used in other foods. This is because MSG is an economical way of stimulating great taste. If you're making a chicken stew but can't afford a whole chicken, why not use a little chicken and a lot of MSG? Consumer groups in the USA campaign regularly against its use, but for many of us, MSG will continue to be a part of everyday life. Food, it seems, will always be a matter of personal taste.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.